This is Intelligence Matters, sponsored by Flare, a leader in providing actionable cyber threat intelligence to companies and governments around the world.
Tom Donilon and Steve Hadley are both former national security advisors. Mr. Donilon served as national security advisor to President Obama, and Mr. Hadley served President George W. Bush. They join us today to talk about the U.S. role in the world. We'll be right back with that discussion after a quick break. I'm Michael Morrell, and this is Intelligence Matters.
The lines between geopolitical risk and cyber risk are blurring. Flare is a next-generation, continuous threat exposure management SaaS platform that equips corporate information security teams with world-class collection and continuous monitoring across dark web cybercrime forums, markets, Telegram channels, and sources of geopolitical risk. Flare sets up in 30 minutes, creates actionable intelligence from hour one, and is used by governments, security teams, and threat intelligence teams around the world. You can try Flare's free trial at their website, flare.io. That's flare.io.
So I want to start in a bit of a different place than podcasts like this usually start, right? They jump right in to the substantive issues. And I want to start with the issue of the policy process. And I want to start with the issue of the tools of foreign policy. Tom, maybe you could spend a few minutes talking about the importance of the process of making policy, and has it changed to meet the demands of the times, or does it need to change more? For example, who's on the National Security Council, for example? And then Steve, maybe you could talk about the tools of foreign policy, what we need to invest in. Have we adjusted those to the times, or do we need to do more? So Tom, why don't you start?
Thank you, Michael. Nice to be here with you and Steve. The process is essential. You have a defined group of people in the United States process, for example, right, in the National Security Council Act, that are trying to address a series of multidimensional, complex, simultaneously occurring high-stakes problems around the world. And I can't think of any other way to manage that kind of challenge except through a process which is sound, which has all the right inputs, which makes decisions in a timely way, and which presents options to the president in a timely and high quality fashion. I don't think there's any other way, frankly, to have any confidence that you could do this absent having a high quality process. The process has to include all the right inputs, as I said, for consideration by decision makers and ultimately by the president. It needs to be a process on which all the major players agree. So that it's the exclusive way in which you are bringing all these elements together and ultimately bring them to the president. Otherwise, you'll have chaos and you'll make bad decisions. It needs to be a process by which you pressure test your assumptions and your recommendations. And the only way to do that, I think, is to have the right people in the process and around the table doing that. Dwight Eisenhower once said that, you know, a good process won't guarantee you a great outcome, but a bad process will almost certainly guarantee you a less than optimal outcome. And I think that's true. You know, the process needs to have the right people, and they have the right experiences. As I said, the right inputs. That includes the intelligence community. It includes legal inputs. It includes obviously defense and diplomatic inputs. I think one place where we will need additional people at the table increasingly is in the technology area. If I had to, looking back on my experience and looking at the challenges that our successor Jake Sullivan and his team face every day, I think one area where there's going to be constant need for improvement is in the technological literacy and the technological experience of policymakers in the United States government and national security. Almost all the problems that we face have some technological element to them, which is essential, I think, for the national security team to understand and for the president ultimately to understand. You see that today, and I'll finish up on this. You see that today at the core of the U.S.-China competition. where really kind of essential elements of technology, the direction of technology, what technological developments will mean for economic growth in the United States and its prospect, but also what it means for the United States military capacity going forward, is absolutely essential. So if I had to make one recommendation with respect to the way the world is changing and the way the process has to change, it would be in the area of technology, technology experience, and technology, technological literacy. There is, I think, also today, and there has been in the past, but maybe more so today, a question of bandwidth and how you manage a series of simultaneous problems, particularly when you have the breadth of challenge that you have today, which, and I know we'll talk about this, which is probably the most complex and dangerous security landscape that we have faced, take your time period, in decades, right? Bob Gates, in a recent Foreign Affairs piece, said it was the most complicated and dangerous landscape we faced since World War II. I think there's an argument to be made for that. So there are issues here about how to manage bandwidth, how to prioritize. But I think at the end of the day, I don't think you can really manage the challenges without having a good process. And I think history shows that we can go into some examples. That good process has led, not necessarily automatically, but has led generally to better outcomes, and that a bad process can lead to a significantly lesser outcome. And I think we can go through a lot of mistakes made by the United States over the last 50 or 60 years and ascribe some of it to poor process.
Tom, would you bring in to the NSC new agencies? Would you bring in the Department of Commerce, for example?
I think commerce is important. And I think basically, Michael, the way I would look at it is you have kind of a core set of agencies. And I think that the way that it's being managed today is that with respect to specific challenges, you should bring in those areas of expertise and agencies of expertise. That's the way I would think about it. I do think you need a kind of a core group around the president making working through the general outlook, right, that the administration of the United States has with respect to the world, and then bring in key players for specific issues and challenges. Although I do think that this technology issue is so important. I would think hard about what's the best way to get it represented at the table, in addition to having people who run the big national security agencies having some technology literacy, but also how it gets more represented most effectively at the table. Yeah.
Steve, the tools of foreign policy. How do you think about that?
I think there's a real opportunity here because there are, in some sense, there are more tools available than there have been in the past. The problem is, how do you organize them into an effective policymaking process? I agree with what Tom has said, just to pile on a bit. I think there's a misconception out there about the National Security Council and the National Security Council process. The president is the decision maker in that process. The National Security Council does not make decisions. It is structured to advise the president and assist the president in making decisions because he's the only one that the American people have voted for and put in office to make those decisions within the executive branch. So when you say, do you have a good process? The real question is, are you bringing to the president the range of information and he views that he or she needs in order to make good decisions? And one of the both challenges and opportunities, and Tom mentioned it in terms of tech, is there is a lot of new players in foreign policy that don't show up at the interagency table, don't show up at the NSC interagency table to advise the president. Of course, you have traditional intelligence tools, but there's a huge amount of open source literature and information that is not classified, that is out there on the internet, that needs to be mined and used in an effective way. There are new players. American business is very active overseas, has a perspective and information that is very important for the decision makers and the president to understand. Tom mentioned, of course, about technology. Well, the technology that is going to drive the future is in the private sector. It's not really in the government. So how do you bring those private sector views into the policy process? There are universities that are active overseas. There are charitable foundations active overseas. There are NGOs overseas. They are a source of information and influence for the United States. So there's a multiplicity now of opportunities for information and influence that we did not have before. And the question is, how do you bring them into the policy process? We haven't solved that problem. We spent a lot of effort making it a whole of government process. That is to say, get all the relevant governmental department of agencies at the federal level, at the state level, and even in the local level involved in the process. But there's also something which is almost a whole of society effort. How do you bring into the process those non-governmental institutions that are playing an increasingly critical role in foreign affairs overseas and can be a source of information and influence to U.S. government? We haven't even begun to solve that problem.
So are both of
Michael,
you...
can I make one more add on one thing?
Sure.
And one thing with Steve. This point on the private sector and technology is really essential. The administration has really turned itself towards much more investing in the science and tech space, which had atrophied over the last couple of decades. And we've made important turns in order to increase our capacity as a country, but also to increase our national security posture and better it in the world. So people point back to the post-Sputnik era, right? You know, kind of one of the last times, you know, the last time maybe that the United States, I guess we also made big investments, obviously during the Reagan era, with respect to investments in technology, but it was a very different world. It was a world where most of the investment and expertise was actually in the government, and that's changed dramatically. Where now most of the expertise and a lot of the investment, right, is now in the private sector. So Steve's exactly right, I think, in terms of the essential nature of having to build this relationship between the United States government and the private sector with respect to the foundational technologies.
So what do you both see as the proper relationship going forward between the government and the private sector? How do we answer Steve's questions about how we bring them in and what does that look like, right? And do that in a way that's consistent with our values.
Well, one of the things is you got to be willing to talk to them. And I think there is an instinct among many in the executive branch that somehow you shouldn't be talking to business. There has been in a number of administrations a reluctance to bring people into the government who have business experience. The conflict of interest rules and the like, ethics rules and the like, make that difficult to do even when an administration wants to bring people with business experience into the government. You've got to be willing to have a process where you're willing to meet and listen to the perspective of business, of NGOs, of charitable foundations, and all the rest. So you got to kind of break down a barrier of reluctance to deal with these communities, which I think you find in the executive branch. That's for starters. And then the question, can you regularize the process in a way that you respect ethical considerations and conflict of interest rules, but nonetheless can get the benefit of what the private sector can bring to the table when you have a policy process?
So let's move to the issue, Tom, that you spent a little bit of time talking about, and that is, you know, what the world looks like today from a national security perspective. What are the challenges and threats? How are they different or the same from when you both were national security advisor? How do we think about the U.S. role in the world, you know, given those challenges and threats? Steve, why don't we start with you this time?
So one of the questions is why all the disorder in the world today? And I agree with Tom. I agree with Bob Gates. This is the most challenging situation we have faced since World War II. You've got a war of Russia on Ukraine. You've got an active war between, Hamas's brutal attack on Israel and Israel's effort to defend itself against that. You've got the tensions with China over Taiwan. But those are sort of the manifestations of what is an underlying phenomenon, which is that the international system that the United States and its friends and allies established at the end of World War II, these various institutions and rules and norms which have governed the international system and the way countries interact with each other since the end of World War II, is breaking down. It's breaking down in the face of the reemergence of great power competition, something we thought with the end of the Cold War was a thing of the past. But China and Russia have a different view of what the world order ought to look like, a view that is based much more on authoritarian principles, that does not respect human rights and rule of law in the same way that we do. And they are challenging that order, and they are challenging it on a base of authoritarian principles and sort of state capitalism that are inconsistent with democracy, freedom, and market economics that really were the underpinnings of that international system. So the system's breaking down. We have new challengers in terms of Russia and China, who are great powers with a different governmental system, a different philosophy that they would like to see reflected in a revised international order. You have the rise of middle powers that really matter now, the Turkeys, the Brazils, the Saudi Arabias, the Indias. These countries have their own interests. They are now players in the international system. And in addition, you have these non-governmental entities that we talked about that are key players. So it's a very different international order that we face, and it is much more chaotic. And we are in a transition point at this point from that old international order to something that is really not yet defined, and it will only emerge over the next decade or so. We're in a transition period. It is a challenge for us. It is chaotic, and it really is going to stress our ability to meet those challenges, which we can talk about later, is going to depend a lot more on what we do here at home as much as it is going to depend on what we do abroad.
Tom, do you want to add?
Yeah, sure. I do. I agree with Steve. I think, the post-Cold War period is decidedly in the rearview mirror. You know, we've had this series of cascading crises over the last half decade, from the trade war with China to the COVID crisis, to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, to now the war in Gaza, and the result has been, with those and numbers of some other more kind of foundational changes that Steve outlined, the result has been is that the world has dramatically changed structurally, and these are foundational changes. They're not going to be reversed. We're going to have to move to a different equilibrium, and the structural changes include the building out of kind of oppositional geopolitical and economic blocks, foundational blocks in the world, one led on the West and the other led by China and Russia and others. There are, as Steve said, the rise of and the importance of the what I like to refer to as multi-aligned countries, very important countries, very important economies in the world that we have to deal with. And it's just a more fragmented world. Now, this fragmentation means that the level of cooperation and coordination among the important powers in the world has diminished dramatically. Makes challenging taking on global challenges much more difficult. If you think about kind of you put the world kind of in your mind's eye and think about the fracturing, right? You know, we now have obviously Russia is foundationally now opposed to the West, right, and split from the West. We have an increasingly more competitive and indeed confrontational a posture between the United States, the West, and China. As I said, we have these multi-aligned countries pursuing their own interests and aligning themselves on this particular issue with one side or the other. So it's a very different world that we face today. I think it will require the United States to make some important mindset changes, including the fact that a number of these challenges and the competition that we're in is long-term. It's long-term in nature. And will require long-term investments and attention by the United States to successfully address them.
So you both have mentioned China. It's obviously the pacing challenge here, right? It's the biggest threat to the international order that Steve talked about. We've now had really 6-7 years of a new approach to China, and I wonder how you both think about where we are with China policy. Have we defined the right objectives with regard to what we're trying to achieve? Do we have the right strategic approach? you know, are we off a little bit? Or are we off a lot? How do you think about where we are with regard to China policy? Tom, do you want to go first here?
I think that we've moved into a posture of a long-term competitive and in some places confrontational structural situation with respect to China. I think that's where we are today. I do think that the posture is structural. I think it's rooted in deep perceptions on both sides that the other side is the principal economic and security threat to the other. This has been exacerbated since Xi Jinping's ascension to leadership in China, where he has pursued a much more aggressive, both domestically and international set of policies. I think it's been underscored by a change in outlook in the United States, where, you know, for a number of presidents, 6, 7, 8 presidents, we have pursued a policy of engagement with China. And the story that accompanied that engagement was that China would, as it became wealthier and more integrated into the international community, would become more liberal and democratic. And that story is not true. And the United States and the world has had to come to grips with that. And we are also engaged, as I referenced earlier, Michael, in a, you know, a quite serious, right, and long-term, and in some cases zero-sum competition with respect to foundational technologies going forward. You saw that a bit, by the way, coming out of the summit that President Biden and President Xi had in San Francisco last week, where even the Chinese talk now about the competitive nature of the competition on science and technology, which they had not talked about in that way before. Now, we had the summit, as I said, in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago, and I think that obviously indicated an intention on both sides to try to stabilize the relationship and prevent it from descending inexorably into conflict. I think that was to develop a stronger set of communication modules, mechanisms, right? And both those were accomplished. We can move kind of more towards, I think, a more some stability in the relationship and put some kind of guardrails around it. And I do think that opening up particularly military-to-military communications in a more structured way were important outcomes. But at the end of the day, the structural shift, right, did not take place. It wasn't a structural shift in the relationship between the United States and China. And it's interesting, I don't think either side would say there was. I think this is now settling into, I think, this more competitive posture recognized by both sides. So I think that's where the relationship is at this point. We have a lot of challenges in the United States to successfully meet it. I think that the steps that the administration has taken in terms of investing in the United States, in terms of building out diplomatically the number of important structures in Asia and the region have been important. The leadership that the president, the administration has exercised in a number of instances in the region have been important. We have, I think, several areas where we have work to do, including and especially in our defense industrial base. With respect to our deterrence posture in Asia. I think we have quite a bit of work to do there. I think we have some work to do, and the administration is trying to do that in recent request to Congress to build out multilateral alternatives to the Belt and Road Initiative and other Chinese initiatives around the world in the economic side. But clearly, the United States posture has changed, and I think we are settling into a more competitive posture as we kind of move towards ultimately a new equilibrium. That's where I think we are. I think those are the things, some of the things we've done, and where some of the additional things that we need to work on, especially I think on the defense posture. I do think that the investment, we can talk about this at some length, the investment in the defense industrial base in the United States needs a lot of attention as a priority. Not just with respect to China, but I think most especially with respect to deterrence in Asia.
Steve, do you want to add?
Yeah, I think actually we've done pretty well over the last 5 or 6 years, over 2 administrations. We were kind of a victim of strategic surprise We weren't probably paying attention to what China was doing in terms of its economic growth, its military buildup, its more aggressive diplomacy and efforts internationally. And we had a bit of strategic surprise and kind of a strategic panic. Oh my gosh, what are we going to do? We probably saw China about 12 feet tall rather than their real height. But I think the country has responded, and you've seen a shift within elite opinion and in public opinion on China over the last 5 or 6 years that has been dramatic and more rapid, I think, than anything, any kind of adjustment I've seen really in my professional career. And I think there is an emerging consensus now among both the executive branch and the Congress, Republicans and Democrats, supported, I think, largely by the American people, that China is the principal challenge. And we've got things we've got to do. And I think we've developed kind of a bipartisan policy on what our approach to China ought to be, recognizing it's the challenge that it is, coming up with a policy that basically is going to say that we're going to have to compete with China where we must, confront China where it's in our interest to do so, and cooperate where we can. That's kind of the approach that that we've developed on a bipartisan basis. I think it's the right one. And I think it has gotten China's attention. I think the Chinese convinced themselves, Xi Jinping defends himself some years ago, that the West was in decline, the United States was in terminal decline, and this was China's moment to emerge on the world stage and take its rightful place. And he rolled out a series of policies, you know, aggressive diplomacy, active military activities in the South China Sea, the Belt and Road Initiative to build infrastructure all over the world, and they haven't worked out so well. And I think in some sense, the Chinese thought that they could pursue their own policies without regard to the United States. And the recent meeting here in San Francisco, I think, was a recognition of the Chinese that the United States policy has changed. We are a force that is going to have to be reckoned with. And I think really why he met with President Biden in San Francisco was to try to give us a bit of a panda hug to see if he could kind of slow down some of these adjustments that are putting us in a better position to compete with China over the long term, which is what we must do. But this is a problem I think that we can handle. I think we've made the right adjustments in our policies. We've got to. What we do in the next 5 years is going to really determine how we do in this competition. But the last thing I would say, and I don't want to run on too long here, but China is not 12 feet tall. And China, for all the notion that they play Go while we play checkers and they have a strategic approach, Xi Jinping has made some terrible strategic mistakes. He dropped the hide and bide strategy and became more aggressive internationally, and thereby woke up the sleeping dragon, which was not China, but was the United States, and woke us up to the China challenge. He then inserted the party into the private sector and into the economy in a way that has killed the goose that laid the golden egg and has reduced China's economic growth from double digits to, you know, they're going to struggle to make 3 or 4%. And I think he's made another mistake thinking that foreign companies will invest in China, even though he makes it very difficult for American companies and foreign companies to do business in China. I think that's going to turn out to be a bad bet too, as a lot of companies now decide the China market is too difficult a market and they're beginning to pivot away. So this is not a 12-foot tall adversary. This is an adversary who's made some strategic mistakes. And if we believe in our system, and if we believe in our values and our principles, and we stick to them, we can succeed in this competition.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of our discussion with Steve Hadley and Tom Donilon.
Beacon Global Strategies is the premier national security advisory firm. Beacon works side by side with leading companies to help them understand national security policy, geopolitical risk, global technology policy, and federal procurement trends. Beacon's insight gives business leaders the decision advantage. Founded in 2013, Beacon develops and supports the execution of bespoke strategies to mitigate business risk, drive growth, and navigate a complex geopolitical environment. With a bipartisan team and decades of experience, Beacon provides a global perspective to help clients tackle their toughest challenges.
How do you guys think about kind of stepping away from our own values to some degree, right, in pursuing, for example, industrial policy, or for denying technology, right, to China, stepping away from sort of free enterprise, right, in order for national security purposes. How does that strike you? Do you think that's the right approach? Do you think there's risk inherent here? How do you think guys think about that?
I'll just say one word about that and then over to time. We got to be careful that in competing with China, we don't decide that we've got to mirror image China and do exactly what you're suggesting. Turn away from those values, principles, and approaches that have contributed to our success and which will continue to contribute to our success in this competition with China. So some investment in science and technology, absolutely right. But the kind of industrial policy and political control of economics that the Chinese exercise through the Communist Party, you know, if we go down that road, we're betraying our own principles and we'll ensure our own lack of success in this competition.
Yeah, I'd say a couple of things, Michael. One is that where there are legitimate national security priorities, for the government to put in place things like export controls around some of these foundational technologies, including semiconductors, quantum technology, and artificial intelligence, which are going to be over the long haul essential to national security and our defense, and could enable our chief strategic competitor, makes all the sense in the world to have restrictions on that and to protect that technology here. And we have a long tradition in the United States, a long history of export controls and control on key technologies in the United States. And I think that's appropriate. And I think it's an important part of our strategy, frankly, moving forward. And I think the administration has done a very good job in that. It is challenging, right? And you've got to make the right choices. You've got to make sure that you don't unnecessarily harm U.S. companies as you engage in it. That involves, by the way, having the right kind of technology advisors and private sector interface that you need. I think that that feels to me like an appropriate use of U.S. policy and governmental authority. Secondly, we also have in this country a long history of investing in key technologies in the domestic sphere here. And we've undertaken that in the CHIPS and Science Act. We'll see how that works out over the longer haul. But I think this is a long tradition in the United States of doing that. We have in the United States, since World War II, this incredible golden triangle, if you will, of universities and the government and the private sector working to give us a lead in technology, which has been a spectacular boon to the United States for the last 80 years, right? Our leadership in foundational technologies has been absolutely essential to our not only to our defense, but also to our economic growth. I agree with Steve that we don't want to move towards a space that inhibits the private sector or in other ways doesn't kind of keep our great strength, right, in terms of our competitive nature of our economic system. I don't think we're in any danger of moving anywhere close to where the Chinese government is right now. The government of China, I think Xi Jinping sees China in a long-term struggle with the West. I think they have stated, right? He has stated on a number of occasions that he believes that the East is rising and the West is failing. I think there's been a lot of evidence to the contrary presented as we've been talking about the last few years and I think going forward. But the Chinese have made this is a really big story, obviously, right? Where there has been a change in economic management approach, right? Moving away from the reform and opening approach, right? That China pursued, for Steve said, for several decades, and it resulted in spectacular success, to an approach where really the Chinese Communist Party has inserted itself into every aspect of life in China in a much more aggressive way, including in the business sector. And it has resulted in reduced confidence, both inside China, I think, among private sector actors. And I think it certainly resulted, and the data now shows this, it's resulted in reduced confidence in terms of external investment into China. And we've had, for the first time since 1998, a net reduction, if you will. They're kind of in a deficit with respect to the amount of capital that's coming into the country as opposed to the amount of capital that's coming out of the country. in China. So I think that Steve's right that, you know, some of the choices that have been made here really have been of concern, obviously, to the private sector in China, and it has moved China in a different direction with respect to its economic future. I think, again, we can get into kind of why this is happening. I think a lot of this really is a lot around kind of, you know, Communist Party political priorities and around their belief that they are in a long-term struggle with the United States and with the West, and that the government should allocate capital and not have it allocated in a more, you know, kind of a more distributed way like the United States and the West has done. And that's resulted in these kind of these intrusions, if you will, into it. I think that they would say that they're making decisions about investing in those things which they think are going to be absolutely essential to the competition with the United States. But the result has been, as T said, which is a reduction in confidence around the Chinese economy. So I don't think we're in any danger moving in that direction. But obviously, you do have to be, you know, kind of policy making. You do have to be obviously concerned about not having overly interventionist government policies. But I think that what we've done to date, I think, makes a lot of sense to me, both in terms of protecting our technology, particularly in the military side, and also making the kinds of investments, kind of foundational, basic research investments, which historically have paid off big for the U.S.
Okay, so while China is the pacing threat, right, we've got two huge issues that have hit us, right? One is the war in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the war in Ukraine, and the other is Hamas's invasion of Israel and Israel's response to that. So a war in Gaza. I'll take both of those one at a time. It really seems, Steve, like we're at an inflection point in Ukraine. And I'm wondering if you see that the same way and how you think about where U.S. policy needs to go going forward here. How do you think about Ukraine at this moment?
I think the administration has gotten a lot of credit, rightly, for standing with Ukraine, for rallying our friends and allies in Europe and really around the world to support Ukraine politically, economically, and militarily with equipment and munitions and training and the like. The judgment, I think, that historically people are going to ask the question, which, what if at the beginning of this conflict we had given Ukraine all the arms, munitions, and training we ultimately, a year and a half, almost 2 years in, have given to the Ukrainians? What if we'd given it up front, all at once? Would that have made a difference? And I think there are a lot of people who are going to argue that it would have made a difference, and Ukraine would be in a very different situation today than it is. But we are where we are. And the problem for the Ukrainians is Russia is bringing to bear its mass on the Ukrainian war. It has three times the population, nine times the GDP. Putin is militarizing his industrial base, militarizing his society, convincing them that they are in a long-term struggle against the West, and that it is a military struggle against the West. And over time, that is going to take its toll on Ukraine, both militarily, economically, and psychologically. And so we, for the moment, are at a stalemate. And the question will be, where do we go from here? And we can talk about that.
Tom, do you want to add?
You know, it's interesting. You know, you had this kind of extraordinary interview in The Economist a couple of weeks ago by the commander-in-chief of the Ukrainian armed forces, where he said they were had reached a positional conflict, right? Standoff, almost a World War I-like standoff in eastern Ukraine. But I will say this, that if, you know, the president has requested $64 billion in this latest request to Congress, right, to continue support for Ukraine, if the United States doesn't provide that support, it won't be a stalemate. And we would deny the Ukrainians the absolutely existential and essential elements of their defense that they need and the opportunities that they have to actually push forward over the next over the next year. So these funding issues in the West, and particularly in the United States, are really existential for Ukraine. Absolutely critical. I don't know, Michael, what your analysis is, but that's my analysis. If you go through what the Russians would be able to do, right, absent the kind of consistent support and the specific defense technology that we provided, including air defense and things like this, right? If you look at what would be able to, the Russians would be able to do, as Steve said, they militarize their economy, right, and dramatically increase the number of troops that they're throwing at this problem. I think the number of troops right now in Ukraine from Russia are at twice the level they were at the beginning of the conflict. So this is a really important issue for the United States, I think, and for the West, with respect to continuing support for the Ukrainian forces. And it won't be a stalemate if we don't do that. The last thing I'll say is, and Steve, mentioned your view on this, right? This is. And it can be difficult politically. This is a long-term project for the United States and the West. If you look at what has actually been, accomplished, Putin failed in his initial war aims. He wasn't able to decapitate the Ukrainian government and take over the country. Europe has come together in an extraordinary way, especially NATO. He's brought NATO right to the border of Russia. He's added, really kind of provided the incentive, right, the impetus to add two new members of NATO. Russia's now been isolated, at least from the West. We can talk about the rest of the world if you want. So, and we have significantly depleted Russian armed capability. So there's been a lot accomplished, and to walk away at this point would be just a dramatic mistake, a historic mistake, I think, by the West and the in the United States. I do agree with Steve that we should look at how to put more pressure on Russia through various systems, and including in Crimea and inside Russia. But that's my initial take on just how important this support from the West is.
I would just add, I think Tom is absolutely right. If we don't continue this support, it will mean Russia will succeed. And Russia, if it succeeds in Ukraine, will not stop in Ukraine. Because Putin's goal is to reestablish the traditional Russian empire in historic Russian lands, which happen to include parts of the Baltic states, Poland, and other states in Europe. So it is very important that we continue to stand by Ukraine. There's another thing we should not do. There was a report I saw in the press, a story broken by Bild magazine, which is a German publication, that Scholz and President Biden have basically tacitly agreed not to provide long-range missiles to Ukraine that would allow Ukraine to threaten Russian forces in Crimea, for example, in order to put pressure on Zelensky and the Ukrainians to seek some kind of ceasefire in the coming year. I think that's exactly the thing we should not be doing. We should provide our complete support to the Ukrainians and let the Ukrainians decide when and under what circumstances they would seek some kind of ceasefire arrangement. And I worry for the Ukrainians because I do think the mass that Russia can bring to bear in terms of economically and militarily, the question is really how long can Ukraine hold out militarily, economically, and psychologically, particularly when there are rightist parties that are winning elections in Europe on a platform of ending aid for Ukraine, and there's uncertainty about whether U.S. will be with Ukraine for the long term. And I think one of the things that's very important that the president did in a recent op-ed and has begun to do in speeches, the president needs to explain to the American people why is it an American national security and economic interest to stand with Ukraine and continue to support Ukraine? He's, I think, been slow to do that, and it's essential. When you ask Americans to engage in something vigorous and strenuous overseas, whether with U.S. forces or the kind of military support we're providing you, Ukraine, you've got to explain over and over again to the American people why it is in the interest of a security and prosperity here at home for us to be engaged abroad. And only the president can do that. And the president really needs to do more of that.
So let's get a quick word from both of you on Israel, Hamas, Gaza, the kind of balancing act, Tom, that the U.S. is trying to walk here between supporting Israel and getting hostages out and, you know, managing civilian casualties. How do you think about U.S. policy choices here, and what would you be advising the president?
Well, I do think that the obviously, and President Biden and the United States, along with others, have had a lot to do with the effort to put in place pauses that allow for the return of hostages. And I think that's been obviously a positive on all sides. Obviously, a positive for those families and a positive in Israel to have as many of the hostages returned as possible. But also, it's allowed there to be additional humanitarian assistance, right, to come into Gaza, which is absolutely essential, and will be essential going forward. And I think, you know, Michael, that's the challenge, right? The challenge is and I do think the Israelis will post this break, return to aggressive military action to go after decapitate the Hamas leadership and infrastructure and military capabilities and governance capabilities inside Gaza. It's a very difficult challenge, though, going forward. Because of the humanitarian side of things, and because the circumstances are different. It'd be a very different effort, I think, in the south of Gaza than it was in the northern part of Gaza, because you've had a million people at really the instruction, if you will, and the kind of the clear direction of the Israeli government to move down south. And so you have to get into, I think, a different kind of military approach, a more targeted military approach, targeted at the ideas that they laid out earlier, but with a much and a keener focus on allowing for humanitarian assistance to come into Gaza. We're reaching the point, I think, where that's going to become a very important priority for the world, and it's going to be a significant challenge for the for the Israelis as they pursue, as they should and have the obligation to pursue, their military goals, but they're going to have to be done, obviously, taking into account the humanitarian aspects of this war. And then we need to move, I think, to thinking hard about what comes next. The bridge is really difficult, you know, between kind of the military action here and then some sort of stabilization and including security. Right? And then a broader conversation about what Gaza looks like down the line. That, by the way, it seems to me, I'll say two last things, needs to be a very big Arab project, I think, moving forward. And I think that we should look to states in the Arab world who are, in many cases, doing quite well, right, should focus on how they can both politically and economically move things to a different place. I think that further down the line, we should return to the effort that the United States had underway to establish a relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and also to deepen the security relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. I think that's an important project that we need to get back to. But in the interim period here, in the short period here, there's a very tough challenge, I think, for the Israelis to balance this need to achieve the objective of taking out Hamas and not allowing it to have any military or governance capability inside Gaza, at the same time trying to address the really serious humanitarian needs on the ground in Gaza.
Steve?
I agree with the way Tom has framed this issue. I think he's got it right. You know, I think this issue about the day after, it's going to be a challenge. The Prime Minister of Israel has said they want to eliminate Hamas's capability to threaten Israel and to govern Gaza. And that's going to be a big lift. And the question is, what's the situation going to look like when Israel finally brings its military operation to a close? And what's the day after that? The administration is starting to articulate a set of principles put out first by the Secretary of State about 10 days ago, and then reiterated by the president in his recent op-ed, I think, in the Washington Post. And that involves trying to return to a two-state solution with Israel and Palestinian state and Israeli state and Palestinian state living side by side in peace and security, reconciliation between Israel and the Arab world, the kind of resumption of the efforts to continue the Abraham Accords to include Saudi Arabia, as well as those that have already signed up. I think the real question is going to be, what is going to be the state of mind of the Israeli people when the military operation starts? What conclusions are they going to draw? Are they going to decide that peace with the Palestinians is impossible? They might as well build settlements and annex those settlements that have been established into Greater Israel and basically wall themselves off from the Palestinian people? Or are they going to decide that, in fact, the path of the last, say, 10 years or so was in error and need to go back to try to have some kind of reconciliation with the Palestinian solution, people, and a two-state solution? I don't know what the Israelis public is going to conclude. If there is a way forward, I agree with Tom, it needs to be an Arab-led project. But the real question is, what are the Israeli people going to decide from all of this? What kind of leaders are they going to elect? And what kind of policies are they going to pursue? And I think the jury's out on that. We won't know until this military operation winds down.
So, Mike, one thing on that, in this military side of this thing, as you, as all three of us know, this is not a short-term, a quick operation, right? I mean, to try to eliminate the leadership, the infrastructure, the military capability, the governance capability of a terrorist group like Hamas is a tough operation, and it will take some time. And we'll have to go into different phases, I think, in terms of the military tactics that are used that can be more consistent with having more regular infusions of humanitarian aid into the country because of the length of time it's going to take. Something you can accomplish and say, you know, we're done, right, on day X, right? This will be something, I think, Michael, you'd agree, given our experience, this will take some period of time, which I think reinforces the importance of having a plan towards providing for, the non-combatants, right, including women and children and families and in Gaza. It's a very difficult challenge.
You know, Steve, your comment about the Israeli psyche, I think, is a really important one. One of the questions I've been asking myself is, will the Israelis come to the conclusion that they can no longer live with a revolutionary Iran? I think that question is going to be debated inside Israel. But I think there's a lot of those kind of issues that still have to evolve here down the road. One final question, guys. You both agree with Bob Gates, as do I, that we are in the most challenging international environment since the Second World War. Very briefly, optimistic or pessimistic of our ability to manage this going forward? Steve?
I'm optimistic. I think we can do it. But I think it depends a lot on what we do here at home. And we're not particularly, and Bob also says in his foreign affairs article, we are not well positioned at the present time to deal with these challenges. We have a political system that seems to be dysfunctional, unable to solve problems. We've really known what the solution is to the immigration problem, to entitlements, to our physical challenge. We've known what the solution is for 20 years. We just have not been able to get a political, sustainable, bipartisan consensus on behalf of those solutions. We got to fix our political system, show that it can actually produce solutions to problems. We've got to have our economic system that provides a wide participation and economic growth that is an inclusive economic growth and doesn't leave any communities behind. And we've got, by doing so, we've got to address the grievance of a large number of Americans who feel aggrieved by globalization, threatened by immigration, abandoned by their politicians, and who have lack of confidence in our institutions. We've got to reconnect and revive the confidence of the American people in our own institutions and our values and principles. If we can do that, we will have a platform that will allow us to engage internationally and protect our interests and deal with these problems. But a lot of it is going to depend what we do here at home, in addition to the kind of investments in our R&D and those sorts of things that Tom was talking about. So we can do this. Whether we will do it depends a lot on what we do at home politically, economically, technologically, and in a dialogue with our own people.
Tom.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, though, this is a super risky moment for the United States and the world. There are any number of the situations which could go badly, and in almost all cases, it will require long-term attention and focus by the United States. I think that's that long-term focus. It is a very different world than the post-Cold War period, right? This is not something which is going to let up, right? In terms of the need for our focus, attention, our hard power, right? Our diplomatic engagement, right? This is not something that's going to switch off anytime soon. This is a super risky moment for the United States and for the world. And the United States needs to stay focused on this as a long-term project. I think it's absolutely within our capability to do it. And I'm optimistic, as Steve is, but we shouldn't underestimate the risk. How many actors there are out there who could throw the system in very dangerous direction. To reinforce Steve's point, you know, Kennan and his famous, you know, articles and with respect to containment focused obviously on the external issues of containing the Soviet Union, but also very much focused on the internal elements that were necessary for the United States to have the strength to deal with these challenges. And these internal elements are absolutely essential in the United States with respect to the political system functioning, with respect to our long-term management of our finances. But I think increasingly, on the health of our society, and I mean that in a kind of a literal sense, that we have, Michael, if you had an analyst, right, looking at the United States as a foreign country, right, they would be coming to you with reports about aspects of the real health of our society where we are not focusing, whether it be life expectancy, drug and alcohol abuse, mental illness issues, right? You know, we have real health issues in the United States. And again, I think you headed up intelligence assessments at the CIA for a long time. I think you'd be paying attention to that if you were doing an analysis of us as a foreign country.
Absolutely.
And just to connect those two things, if we don't address these problems here at home, the social issues Tom talked about, the economic, political issues I talked about, you will not have the support of the American people for the kind of long-term engagement and leadership internationally that is going to be required to deal with the long-term challenges that we face as a country. So these things are related. We got to fix ourselves at home, or we won't have the support of the American people to engage abroad the way we need to do in order to protect American national security and economic interests.
Steve, Tom, thanks you so much for joining us. Quite a conversation.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Michael.
Thanks.
That was Tom Donilon and Steve Hadley. I'm Michael Morrell. Please join us next week for another episode of Intelligence Matters.
Intelligence Matters is produced by Steve Dorsey with assistance from Ashley Berry and Sophia Rubin. Intelligence Matters is a production of Beacon Global Strategies.